Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Now, one of my favorite football plays, maybe yours as well, is the blitz, where the defense sends the extra man or two or all of them to try and disrupt the quarterback. We're going to talk about facing the blitz today on Connecting Faith. Did you know we're doing a football show
today?
Yeah,
it's very timely. Two nights from now, we will have the opening game featuring the Super Bowl rematch, right? Carolina, yeah. Denver going at it, and then Sunday, of course. So
everything's launching. Well, we're going to talk to a former NFL quarterback who quarterbacked for 11 seasons. You know, if I mentioned the Rams, the 49ers, the Seahawks, the Eagles, you're thinking,
who is that?
Yeah. Jeff Kemp is our guest, and we're going to get to Jeff in a moment. And he's not really doing football now. In fact, he's talking about facing the blitz, three strategies for turning trials into triumphs. And he's one of the VPs at Family Life. And we're going to get some great insight on family, marriage, and relationship with Jeff Kemp coming up in just a minute. First, some important news about family and relationships on The Point.
The science is settled, we often hear. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. On nearly all of the so-called pelvic issues, the issues having to do with sex, gender, marriage, and identity, the media has decided for us the debate is over. The science is settled, we're told, that same-sex attraction is nature, not nurture, that gender is a spectrum unrelated to biological reality, that the moderating of behavior is harmful, that same-sex parenting is just as good as a mom and a dad, and that suicide rates will spike if we don't fully affirm the lifestyle choices and self-identification of each person. Now, please let me say this as clearly as I can. The science isn't settled on these issues at all. Don't fall for it. And when someone claims it, ask them, where does that information come from? On the transgender issue, our friends at the Christian Medical and Dental Association have just produced a thorough, researched, and holistic report. It's a must-read for anyone who wants to understand this issue. Come to breakpoint.org, and we'll link you to it. That's breakpoint.org. I'm John Stone Street.
Happy to spend some time today talking with Jeff Kemp. Jeff quarterbacked 11 seasons for the NFL's Rams, 49ers, Seahawks, and Eagles. Today, he's quarterback for the family, committed to transforming men for others and building marriages that thrive. And he's a vice president at Family Life, the national ministry. Of course, you hear Family Life today regularly here on Faith Radio, and we're just honored to have Jeff with us. He's written a great book out, I think maybe a year or so, called Facing the Blitz, Three Strategies for Turning Trials into Triumphs. And we're going to spend a little time diving into that. Also want to talk, though, about an event that he and his wife, Stacy, will be doing in the Minneapolis area for those in the Twin Cities listening area, The Art of Marriage Live. And it's you maybe heard of the Family Life's Art of Marriage. This is has live teaching, and we're going to find out a little bit more about that as we go along as well. Jeff, welcome to Connecting Faith. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be with you and your listeners.
So, I know we want to talk the Art of Marriage live event, but I think a lot of us are pretty excited about football, and you were an NFL quarterback. Was that a dream of yours? And maybe just what did it take to reach that?
Well, it was a dream, but it was kind of a normal thing in my family. My dad was an NFL quarterback and played for the Buffalo Bills, played 13 years of pro football. And so when I grew up, it was like, I guess I want to be like my dad when I grew up and play football. I didn't realize it was kind of a tough job to get. I was decent in high school, but not a superstar. I went off to Dartmouth College. I wasn't drafted in the NFL. I was a free agent and went out to the Rams and made it there, went to the Rams, the 49ers and the Seahawks and then the Eagles. But I did work hard, of course, and I really did have that dream. And to me, it seemed a little more possible to the normal person because my dad had done it. And yet I knew in college the odds were pretty slim. But I always kind of had a feeling in the back of my mind, this is what I'm going to do. But I got to give God the credit for putting things in the right place to allow me to make the team. In fact, I met my wife the first summer I was going into NFL, and she didn't meet me personally. She wrote me a letter and was actually praying that I would have a good training camp if a guy would open doors for me. And it was crazy to look back and see what happened. All these quarterbacks got hurt. I got to play a lot. I ended up making the league. And then we met within about 2 or 3 weeks of her writing me that letter and starting to pray for me at the exact time that we were having practice. So I guess my wife and God get most of the credit, but I did work hard.
Which is probably actually the way most of life should be. I guess if we were serious about it, we would give our wives and God more credit than we probably should or do. Just before we kind of dive into your ministry now, I heard some numbers recently about, you know, how shockingly short the average careers in the NFL and how many are broke or maybe even suicidal or both after leaving the game. Is it really that tough a business?
Well, I mean, the average career is a little under 4 years, and it's such an unreal life. You get into it, and all of a sudden, you're on the pedestal, you're center stage, the pressure, the adrenaline, the attention. And when you're treated like everything revolves around you, it's hard to make your individual relationships go well. You know, the person who invests and gets a 5% return, that's boring to an NFL athlete. He's making a ton of money, and the guys in the locker room are bragging to him about making 200% on some investment, and it's all just puff and hype. But so people take risks, and they spend a lot, and there are a fair amount of bankruptcies and a lot of debt and a lot of relationship breakups. And a lot of guys kind of lose their identity when they get out of football because they built it all around that status as an athlete. And that's a hard, success is sometimes very, very hard to deal with. Certainly, it can create pride, but it can also create insecurity because you're not sure if people like you for who you are inside as a person or for what you've done and what you have and the fame that goes with it. So I'm not trying to engender sympathy per se, but it is not an easy road. And that's why a lot of pro football players really turn to the Lord. They turn to the chapel. They turn to the Bible study. They have close buddies. In my case, I grew a ton as a Christian in pro football, largely because I had such a great network of Christian teammates and chapel leaders and resources. So it was a good place for me.
You know, in the opening sentence of your book, Facing the Blitz, you remind us that quarterbacks can't do anything without help, and husbands are in the same situation. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, a quarterback, the center has to snap on the ball, the line has to protect, the receivers have to run the right routes and catch the ball. You just depend so much upon other people. Yes, the quarterback does a lot, but he depends totally on others. And there's a sense of humility in that. And I think that life comes down to two things, pride and humility. Pride led to everything bad, beginning with Lucifer and his fall and all the dumb arguments that we've gotten into, the times where we defend ourselves or we argue or we buck up or we look out for ourselves or we think we're special or other people are less than us. Pride is the root of division and isolation and breakup. Humility, it's the beginning of all good things. Jesus Christ was humble and came to earth, took on the form of a human being, was humble enough to serve, humble enough to die on the cross. And our humility is what leads us to God. It's what reconciles marriages. It's what makes for a good parent. A humble parent is going to do a much better job raising their kids, and certainly a humble spouse is going to build a much more intimate and united team than a proud spouse. So there are, I think, great team analogies from sports that transfer into life, and particularly into marriage, where you got to realize I need God to be the husband I need to be, and I need my wife to be the team that I need to be. We need each other to be the best person we can be and the best parents we can be. So I think humility is a starting point for good things.
Talking with Jeff Kemp today. Jeff quarterbacked 11 seasons for the NFL's Rams, 49ers, Seahawks, and Eagles. And we are talking with him today. He's vice president of Family Life. It's a national ministry leader in conferences and other resources to enrich marriages and families. Jeff, that's why Stacy has been married for 30-plus years and have 4 sons, and he's authored the book Facing the Blitz, 3 Strategies for Turning Trials into Triumphs, and we're going to dive into that a bit more in just a moment ahead, as well as talk about the Art of Marriage Live, an event coming up. We want to tell you more about that all ahead on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we've connected with Jeff Kemp today. Jeff is with Family Life Ministries. He's a vice president there. He played in the NFL for 11 seasons, and he's written a wonderful book called Facing the Blitz, Three Strategies to Turn Your Trials into Triumphs. And Jeff, I'm sure that, you know, you grew up around football, and, you know, we love kind of sports and metaphors, and maybe we should just talk a little bit about the blitz and define that, and, you know, maybe just to say a bit about what those strategies are for turning our trials into triumphs.
Well, the blitz in football is when the defense is going to send a lot more players than normal to attack the quarterback and the offense. They'll probably send 5, 6, even 7 players to attack the quarterback, try to create a fumble, interception, a sack, an injury. But the interesting thing about the blitz is it can either turn really bad for the offense or it can turn really good, because it's not just danger, it's also opportunity. Meaning, if the defense is committing so many people to attack the quarterback, there's fewer to cover the pass plays or to be in the backfield to stop a long run. So some of the biggest touchdown passes come when the offense reads the blitz, adapts, adjusts. People sacrifice. They dive in front of players to block them for the quarterback. Quarterback might get hit in the jaw and fall down after he throws the ball, but the ball's in the end zone with a touchdown. So that's the blitz, both danger and opportunity. And the metaphor of the book is really that most people don't have a strategy for problems in life. We try to avoid them. We hope they're not going to happen. But the reality is, Jesus said, in this world, you're going to get blitzed. I guess he said in the NIV, it might say, you're going to have trouble. But don't panic. I've overcome the world. Jesus went through a blitz to win our salvation. And the Apostle Paul says that trials and tribulations and difficulties and losses and hardship and persecution and suffering, blitzes, if you will, actually are something that we can rejoice in. The opportunity that they bring to persevere towards Jesus, to grow character like Jesus, to have our hopes set in heaven like Jesus, and then to feel more of God's love when we're not counting on our circumstances, but we're counting on our salvation and the hope of the glory to come of an eternal life. So blitzes can make us less selfish and more other-centered, more long-term and less short-term. More forgiving and less judgmental. Sometimes they change our life dramatically. You know, you might lose a limb and have to quit a sport, but come up with a new career helping people that have been through something such as an amputation. So anyway, the blitz is an opportunity as well as a crisis, but we need to have strategies for how to face life's challenges, and that's really what the book is about. I can go into those three strategies. And,
yeah, let's dive in, because I think, you know, just like a good football team, you have to prepare for sort of every eventuality. I mean, probably don't prepare as much as we should. But you say there's three basic things. You just kind of touched on them, but let's dive in a little bit more about how we can prepare.
Three basic things. The first is you need a long-term view on your life. You can't face the hardship just by looking at that evening, that day, that week. You know, a bankruptcy can't be looked up in the light of just, oh my gosh, this month is the worst month of our life. You need to take a long-term time horizon. There was a mom that didn't want to be divorced, and her husband left her. He divorced her, and she's left raising this 10-year-old boy, and the boy breaks his arm at the beginning of baseball season and wants to quit the team. And his mom says, you know, son, I think I've seen a characteristic of commitment in you that sticks with things. And I think if you stick with this baseball team and you're the biggest encourager, even though you can't bat and run and hit, I think your character of commitment will show up, and someday you'll prove what a great husband and daddy you're going to be because of that characteristic of commitment. She had the long term in mind as she was continuing to coach her son through a blitz. So the first thing is keep the long term in mind. Second is be willing to change and adapt. I mean, there was a husband that had found his wife in an affair, and most guys would just get mad and judge her and they want to blame her and criticize her. And he actually pulled away and asked himself the question, man, from the day we married until now, what could I have done or not done that let my wife fall out of love with me? And thinking about that, he realized he was so busy with Little League sports doing the Boy Scouts and his job that he hadn't been paying attention to his wife and dating her, talking to her, prioritizing her. And he actually apologized to her for letting her fall out of love with him. Now, he didn't excuse her affair, but the interesting thing was, by focusing on himself and how he could change, she humbled herself, asked to go to counseling, and they rebuilt their marriage. So the first strategy is a long-term view. The second is be willing to change yourself. You can't change others, but you can change yourself. And then the third is take your focus off yourself as a victim and focus on blessing others. I remember I was in training camp one year. It was going bad. I couldn't find a home to rent in Philadelphia for our family. I wasn't getting many repetitions. I wasn't playing well. Guys were dropping balls. Protection was weak. And I kept kind of whining to my wife on the phone each night. I've been gone for 5 weeks. And my wife said, Jeff, you just need to find someone in camp who's also kind of struggling and focus on encouraging them. And I did. I found a rookie that it was really homesick and lonely and wasn't doing that well. And I started encouraging him, taking him to lunch and dinner, patting him on the back, praying for him. And he made the team, and I got cut. But it changed my attitude that summer. So when you're in a blitz, you need a long-term perspective. You need to be willing to change and adapt and grow, become a different and better person, maybe try something new. And third, you need to focus on blessing others, not just stewing in your own difficulty as a victim.
You know, in that sort of reaching out, and you talk about team, obviously we know about teamwork. We all give a lot of lip service to it. But, how will building a team help us overcome trials? Say a little bit more about that.
Well, those strategies sound pretty easy to say. They're hard to do unless you can be a teammate in life instead of doing things on your own. It takes some humility to raise your hand and say, you know what, I'm struggling. I need some help. But that's the beginning of getting the mentoring, the support, the prayer, the encouragement that we need. So all of us need to realize everyone is struggling. Everyone has their backstory. Everyone has difficulties. And it honors people to ask them to be a help to you, to be an encouragement to you. And, of course, we were meant to help others and be that safe person that they can count on. You need to share your burdens. That's part of what the biblical command, bear one another's burdens. The Bible says that together we are God's masterpiece. It doesn't say that alone we're a masterpiece. Together we're his masterpiece. So teamwork is crucial, and you really need to realize that we have different giftings. Some people are dominant leaders. Others are sensitive listeners. Some people are introverts. Some people are extroverts. In marriage, opposites attract, and then they attack after they get frustrated with their differences. But if they realize that, you know what, those opposite giftings of my spouse are God's exact special formula to complement me, and also if there's some friction in our marriage, this is meant to humble me so that I conform to the image of Christ. Marriage is both beautiful and very hard. It's the most important team in the world, and we need God to anchor that team. And if you receive your spouse as a gift, and this is one of the things we'll talk about at the Art of Marriage Live on the 16th and 17th of September, if you receive your spouse as a gift from God, then you continue to invest in and lift that person, appreciate that person, cherish that person. Even if they're imperfect, you realize, you know what? God's trying to make me a better person, and handling some of these imperfections and difficulties in our marriage is what's drawing me closer to him. It's what's making me more humble. So you need teamwork, or you would never have God shape you to be the person you were meant to be, and we certainly can't do as much alone as we can together.
You know, you talk about receiving your spouse as a gift. I know in the book Facing the Blitz, you do talk about, you know, that we're so performance-oriented, and we sometimes have preconditions on performance, and maybe we look at our spouse that way and say, well, you know, if you do this, then I'll do this. Talk about how we can develop maybe a new value system, why that's so critical.
Well, it's a performance-driven culture. I mean, everything is conditional, and yet God has a completely opposite value system. You know, in Romans 5:8, it says that God demonstrated his love in this unconditional way, that while we were still sinners, before we deserved it, Christ died for us. And that really is the essence of what we're committing to in marriage, you know, in sickness and health, in plenty and in want. No matter the situation, I'm pledging myself to care for you, nurture you, love you, be loyal to you, be faithful to you. So that unconditionality is crucial. Now, we need to see our spouse through God's lens. And God's lens says, I don't focus on the imperfections. He focuses on the sacrifice of Christ that forgave those sins and will someday perfect those imperfections. And you need that cup half full attitude that says, you know what, I'm thankful for my spouse, and I'm thankful for the challenges that we face in our marriage because they drive us to Christ and conform us more to his character. So an unconditional relationship-based value system is basically saying, God loved me unconditionally. I'm going to love my spouse or my children unconditionally. And you will have a far better relationship and a far more joyful life if you take that approach. But it's very difficult to do apart from getting your love first from God. He loved us first so that we could then go love others.
I'm thinking even to expand on that, you know, maybe when life knocks us down, when we get blitzed, I mean, we can tend to feel like, well, we don't have any value of our own. So, I mean, we need to understand that, you know, God has placed high value in us.
Oh, man, that's a great point. I think a lot of people look around and compare themselves to other people. And it's such a performance-driven society, and we measure so many things. There's money, cars, houses, looks, body shape. Did your kids get into this college or didn't they? You know, you walk into church and see that family that looks all together and you think, oh, my gosh, they're so good, so spiritual, so happy. We're comparing their outsides to our insides. And on our insides, we know we had an argument in the car on the way over here, and we have a kid that's struggling with drugs, and we argued, you know, last night and the week before. But you know what? Everyone has their internal struggles. We weren't meant to compare. We were meant to connect to the Creator, Jesus Christ, the Father in heaven, the power of the Holy Spirit. And what does he say about us? You're worth so much that I died on the cross for you. You're my son or daughter in whom I'm well pleased. I've put my righteousness in you. And I think we parents need to bring that positive view to our kids, that you are loved unconditionally. You're God's cherished creation. Yes, the kids will compare and mock, and there'll be some, you know, bullying and bad treatment and comparison. But God knows who you are. We know who you are, and you're valued. And we husbands need to do that for our wives. You're beautiful inside and out. And wives, boy, if you want to have power and influence over your husband, if you really want to be strong in your marriage, then use the most important characteristic possible that a man needs, which is respect. Women need unconditional love. Men need unconditional respect. You still speak the truth and you still guide him, but you do it in a way that meets a man's deepest need. We're all vulnerable and kind of insecure deep down, and we can do a lot by bringing God's love and confidence into people.
We'll talk more about how we can build in love and respect in our relationships. And we're going to talk the Art of Marriage Live. It's an event that Jeff and Stacy Kemp will be doing here coming up in just a few days. Jeff is one of the vice presidents at Family Life, and he has authored a book called Facing the Blitz, Three Strategies for Turning Trials into Triumphs. He had more than a decade in the NFL and has given him some valuable insights on servant leadership and teamwork and overcoming adversity. And we're going to hear more about it in the moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. Listen to Connecting Faith, and we're honored to have with us Jeff Kemp today. Jeff played as a quarterback in the NFL for 11 seasons, and he has since been committed to helping marriages and families grow strong. He's now vice president at Family Life, a national ministry, and has authored the book Facing the Blitz, Three Strategies for Turning Trials into Triumphs. He and his wife, Stacy, have 30-plus years of marriage and four children, and they're doing an event called The Art of Marriage Live in the Woodbury at Crossroads Church in Woodbury, Minnesota. For those in the Twin Cities area, we'll talk about that here in a moment and give you some more information. By the way, you can find out about that event at familylife.com if you go to that website, familylife.com. Jeff, I want to talk a little bit about in the book Facing the Blitz, you talk about one of the foundations for teamwork is trust, and that's so in any marriage as well. Let's start with some foundational things about the importance of trust.
Well, trust is the key to teamwork because you need to know that the sacrifices you make won't be taken advantage of. And trust really comes from knowing one another and from intimacy. So that's why It's so important to share the stories of our lives with one another. It builds understanding. It builds empathy. And then it builds trust. When you hear someone's backstory, you can kind of understand them better. You're more willing to open up to them. And that builds trust between the two of you. Trust is also built by trustworthiness, right? Behaving in ways where you keep your promises, you protect confidences, you show up on time, you do the things you say you're going to do. It's crucial in teamwork on a sport, you know, for a quarterback to trust the offensive line, for the wide receivers to trust the QB, QB to trust the wide receivers, the defense. Each guy's playing a position and trust other guys to handle their responsibility. But we're talking about relationships. And even the nature of our faith in God is based on trust. And trust is a form of faith there because he did come. He did prove himself in real life. He lived his life. He died on the cross. He was buried. He was risen from the dead. 500 people saw that and witnessed that. It's been written down to us in the scriptures. But we don't actually see Jesus. And we still need to believe. And then beyond that, you know, there's a difference between pointing at a chair and saying, hey, I believe that tree, that chair will hold me up, and actually sitting down in it and saying I'm entrusting all of my weight into that chair. So trust is making yourself vulnerable to someone. And people are imperfect, so we will be hurt from time to time. But intimacy comes from trust. So it makes sense to talk deeply and learn the stories of one another and see what the background is, see why their personality is wired that way. That's why marriages should begin with a lot of preparation. They should have a mentor couple. My son and his, well, his bride, he's been married 3 days now.
Okay.
They were mentored for 9 sessions by a wonderful married couple and took them through a book from Family Life called Preparing for Marriage that asked them all sorts of questions about their dreams, their goals, their expectations, their personality styles. It brought out differences that they probably hadn't anticipated and gave them ways that they'll be able to deal with conflict and arguments and reminded them that everyone has conflict. Everyone has arguments. It's how you handle it in an honorable way that leads to real intimacy. So building trust comes from getting to know people in a vulnerable way and asking about their story, honoring their story, and then revealing your story to them, and then behaving in trustworthy, dependable ways.
I know the event that you're doing, The Art of Marriage Live, and of course, I know Family Life has produced The Art of Marriage DVD and training and equipping series, but it's not talking about the science, it's talking about the art. I mean, say more about that part of it, but there are some fundamentals as well that we need to hang on to.
Well, yeah, marriage is an art, not a science. It's God's invention. It's a picture of Christ's love for the church. So it's that important. A lot of us in America have kind of taken a reduced version of marriage that is more like a consumer item. And we're trained as consumers. We see about 800 ads a day. But we're always kind of thinking, what can I get out of this? What can I get out of this? How is this going to work for me? How are they going to treat me? Will this make me happy? And that's the fundamental error. Marriage is a contest of generosity. That's a quote from Diane Sawyer. If both people are concerned about how they can serve and meet the needs of and lift and encourage and bring out the best in the other person, even when the other person's not at their best and isn't lovable, then you've got a 100% relationship. Both people are pouring into it. And there's days where, you know, my wife is putting in, you know, 80% and I'm putting in 10% or 20%. But overall, my attitude is I'm 100% responsible to make this relationship work. And her attitude is she's 100% responsible to make this relationship work. But it's an art because, boy, we have differing personalities and, you know, differing priorities. And she's an introvert and I'm an extrovert. And she's organized and I'm disorganized and I'm impulsive and she's very methodical. And you know what? That leads to conflict. And the neat thing is when you read about the Bible, you find out that God knows we're going to have conflict. And he coaches us on humbling ourselves. He expects us to have to apologize. He expects us to have to forgive. That becomes an art. That's not a science. That comes from the heart. It's a heart of humility that will apologize first and that will forgive first. And that something really big, even an affair, can be forgiven because we have basically rejected the God of the universe, and yet he died on the cross to forgive us our sins. So forgiven that much, we can forgive our spouse. So we in the Art of Marriage, we talk about God's purpose and plan, the bigger picture of marriage, that love will fade and isolation is the drift that happens in marriage. But there's roles and responsibilities and 100% commitment. 50-50 doesn't work. And communication is essential. It's like the oxygen for a relationship. And conflict, it's around for all of us. So don't get shocked and don't think you married the wrong person. Just learn how to handle it positively, which can actually lead to deeper intimacy. And then intimacy is more than sex. It's the quality of the relationship. And yet sex is an outgrowth. It's a byproduct of a great relationship. It's important, and couples should prioritize their physical relationship, and they need to realize how many counterfeits there are to it in society with pornography and so many kind of images of consumer-based sexuality rather than giving and investing in your spouse. And then the last big message of Art of Marriage is that your marriage is a message to next generations. You're leaving a legacy. You're shaping your children. You're a lighthouse for other couples. You're basically an advertisement for God's gospel. So our marriages are very important.
You're, you know, in fact, I know you talk about that as well in Facing the Blitz about leaving a legacy. Is there one thing we could do today to maybe improve that legacy? I mean, there's, you know, all of us are, you know, are well aware of our shortcomings, but, you know, in whatever age or stage we're in, we still are building a legacy. What can we do today to make a difference?
I think if you will write down on a piece of paper or on your computer or your phone, how do I want to be remembered? And what's the mark I want to make in other people's lives? If you actually begin with the end in mind and think about, what do I want people to say at my memorial service? What character traits and memories do I want planted in my kids or grandkids? If you define that, then you can start praying about that daily. And if you pray about those things, the character of your kids, the future marriages in your family, that your grandkids would come to know Jesus Christ, that your life would reflect on God well and point others to him. Boy, if those are the thoughts in your head and those are the prayers from your heart, then God's going to move you and your life in that direction. So I'd tell people, think through 10, 20, 40 years from now, the impact that you'd like to see your life have, and then start praying that God would make you the sort of person that lives like that and leaves a legacy like that. And definitely pray for your kids' marriages, even if they're not married yet. Pray for your grandkids to come to know Jesus. Pray for your grandkids to marry someone who loves Jesus. The bond of the Lord is the thing that makes a marriage strong, and we pray about those things. God answers prayer.
Jeff, just maybe personally, I mean, after football, professional football, you could have done a number of things. Why did you choose family ministry?
Well, it's funny. My dad, you know, he was a congressman and ran for vice president and stuff like that. So leadership was in the family, and he raised us in this way where every time we left the house, he'd say, remember, you're a Kemp, be a leader. And that mantra was in us. You're a leader. You need to make a difference. And it really stuck. But I was around enough ministry and did enough with kids in schools and some inner city work that I did during off seasons of football that I just had a heart for kids. And I realized that kids don't just go mess up on their own. They're really a function of whether they were loved and nurtured or neglected and damaged by their parents and their family. And so we have an adult problem more so than a kid problem in America. And the only way to fix children is to fix marriage. You can't restore fatherhood without restoring marriage. And you can't raise good boys without good dads. So I wanted to kind of go upstream, and that was marriage, that was family, that was fatherhood. And that's how I moved into the marriage and family strengthening field and ministry. But I view every single one of us as an ambassador for Christ if we've accepted the Lord. And if you're an ambassador for Christ, you're an ambassador for reconciliation. And reconciliation means relationships come back together. And the relationship of a father to a son or a daughter, of a mom to her kids, of a man and a woman, healing their marriage, not coasting and drifting into isolation, letting divorce happen, helping our young people realize that marriage is awesome when you prepare for it and you know what it's all about. You invite God in to be the center of it, and you see it as the safe, beautiful, fruitful place for a sexual relationship. We need to give young people that vision. Today, man, they're afraid of divorce, and so they cohabit and they delay marriage, and sex is an a la carte item on the menu of life, and there's a whole lot of aftertaste and negative consequences that don't happen when you have a God-honoring and loyal, faithful marriage.
Jeff, I know that we're hoping that many that are in the Twin Cities listening area would be a part of the Art of Marriage Live at Crossroads Church in Woodbury.
On the 16th and 17th of September, we'd love them to come.
But obviously, we have listeners all across the Upper Midwest and Hartford and around the country online. But so maybe just say a challenge about an encouragement to someone listening that they don't just allow coasting and drifting to take place, that they go to Family Life and find some of the great resources that you have available.
I think I'd begin by telling people that relationships are the most important thing in life. God's a God of relationships. So don't coast in your relationships. Put some training and some effort and some prayer. Invite God into your relationships. And Family Life is designed to help you learn God's blueprints, understand the power of the gospel, gain forgiveness for your sin, and an agape love that can transcend the difficulties of your relationships. We have Weekend to Remember marriage conferences, a couple of them in Minneapolis, in fact. The Art of Marriage Live on the 16th and 17th. The Art of Marriage video that people can use anywhere, anytime, in their home, at their church, with some business friends. So go to familylife.com, look up some of those marriage resources, invest in the quality of a relationship. You may want to invest in your teenagers and your 10 and 11-year-old and give them a picture of healthy relationships, dating, how to stay away from pornography, what God's good blueprints are for sex. We've got resources for that, the Passport to Purity, Passport to Identity. So familylife.com has a lot of resources to strengthen relationships so you can build the marriage, the family that God intended that will shape the next generation for good.
Also, if people want to kind of read, I know you do a regular devotional once a week at facingtheblitz.com, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I got a video, 1-minute video, and a little Bible devotion. And there's also a free Bible study and a discussion guide for the book, Facing the Blitz, that folks are using. So those are at facingtheblitz.com. And you can sign up for the 1-minute devotion each week or for the free Bible studies and discussion guide that go with the book.
Jeff, thanks for your leadership in this area, for your encouragement today, and for your role at Family Life. We just pray God's blessing on you and Stacey and your family, and especially as you go out and share these opportunities to help us grow in our marriage at Art of Marriage Live events. Thanks again.
Yep. I hope we see people on the 16th and 17th at the Woodbury, or they jump online and find their own Weekend to Remember or other marriage resource for their marriage.
Jeff Kemp joining us today on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and during the final segment of our program today, we want to shift our focus to religious freedom, particularly as it affects Christian colleges and organizations. Let me set up the story. Recently, a California lawmaker withdrew his bill, the Equity in Higher Education Act, as he called it, that targeted Christian colleges who want to uphold their religious tenets regarding sexual identity. But he did reserve the right to resubmit it. Now, it seems like this issue is not going away, and we wonder, are Christian colleges and universities like the University of Northwestern, where Faith Radio is housed, prepared for the increased pressure, intrusions, and directives attacking traditional values? To answer that question, I invited the president of the University of Northwestern Media, Dr. Alan Cureton, into the studio to talk with him and get his perspective on this seemingly growing trend of pushing against religious freedom and traditional values. The Faith Radio Network is owned and operated by the University of Northwestern Media. Here's Dr. Alan Cureton.
What happened here was this lawmaker, in my belief, trying to establish a legacy bill for himself as a young lawmaker looking to the future. What he was pursuing was the opportunity to protect students that are a student that's attending a faith-based institution in California. There are about 40 of them out there in regards to LGBTQ issues. This lawmaker is openly gay and not apologetic about it at all. Okay, so he was in his quest looking to protect the rights of those students that might be discriminated against by these faith-based schools due to religious convictions. So he was proposing a law that said that if an institution in the state of California defined marriage as between one man and one woman or did not designate their restrooms by gender, in other words, you restricted it to your biological assigned gender, therefore they would lose the right to use a state grant from the state of California for that institution. So they have a private state grant fund the students can take to any institution in the state, and it's about $10,000 a student. The state grants are wonderful things because it not only does it give the student an opportunity to decide which college you want to go to, public or private, but it also relieves the burden on the public institutions because the private schools, an investment of $10,000 is much more cost-effective for the state than sending them to a public university where they have to foot the whole bill, which might be somewhere in the 30s or 40,000s, right? So what the implications for institutions like California Baptist or Fresno Pacific or Point Loma Nazarene were significant if you have 1,000 students on your campus that are receiving this grant, multiply that times $10,000. I mean, it's a huge issue. Plus the fact, from the student's perspective, I've just lost the opportunity to go to the institution that I wanted to go to. So we were totally against this bill, as you can imagine, in the faith-based community, because we saw it as an invasion of our religious freedom, the rights protected to us by the First Amendment. What's the interesting thing that's going on right now in Washington and also across some state capitals in the United States and in the minds of people throughout the country as our culture is going through some type of change is how do we define religious freedom? And for most people, they're defining it as the freedom to worship. In other words, what I do on Sunday mornings at 11 o'clock, why they're asking us, why does that impact the rest of your week? Well, for you, for people like you and I who go to church, that drives everything for the rest of the week. So our freedom of worship is our religious freedom. So everything we do at Northwestern revolves around a biblical worldview. We teach from that perspective. My bias is I think we have more academic freedom here than you do at a public university, which is dominated by political correctness. Okay. So. And so how do we convey then to the greater culture as a faith-based community the totality or the vastness of religious freedom and the right to assemble? So don't forget, that's also part of the First Amendment that gives us a right to assemble as a group. So you and I can gather together and worship, but we can gather together as a community. Now, historically, the courts have always interpreted our expectations as a university or as every other faith-based school, whether it be Jewish, whether it be Catholic, whether it be Protestant, evangelical, the whole bit, that it was a contract. So the students would apply or faculty would apply or staff, understanding the parameters and the expectations of the community based on theological or doctrinal positions. The courts would say, did you give this person a right to due process? As we would implement our things. So just to give you an example, on our campus, we're saying to students, if you come to Northwestern, we're asking you not to participate in sexual activity until you're married. In other words, we're encouraging them to pursue a life of holiness. If a student is involved in sexual activity, which is commonplace on most university and college campuses, as young people are, that's their choice. I mean, the universities don't get into that. But at Northwestern, we're just saying, a life of celibacy in the quest of a life of holiness is the calling right now. So if you want to participate in that element in your life right now, we ask you to go somewhere else to study. And the courts would always interpret that as saying, okay, as long as you've given the student a due process and the chance to appeal the decision. What this law was saying is that if you discriminate against a student, LGBTQ, who's pursuing their lifestyle, you can no longer receive the state grant. Anyway, so what happened was is that as we gathered momentum to stand up against this, because what's fascinating to me is that this law was submitted right after the commencement season in May. And it passed the committee and got to the Senate, passed the Senate, and it was on a fast track. And it happened over the summer months. And, you know, most institutions aren't in session. You know, I mean, it's like we're all in Minnesota. We're up at the cabin. You know, it's kind of – and then all of a sudden we get this, uh-oh, we better start moving because this is going to – this law could pass before the fall semester started. So all of a sudden you get this huge inertia going to react and respond to this law, which, I really applaud the evangelical community to do that. But let me tell you, it was – the Mormons got together with us. The Catholics got together. The Jews got together with us. The Muslim university got together with us and said, look, you know, you're discriminating against our opportunity to exercise our freedom, religious freedom. Also, students who were many of the ethnic minority races were saying, hey, wait a minute. Why, you know, you're telling me that I can't go to this university that I want to go to and can afford to go to now, and you're forcing me now to go to a public university that I don't want to go to or I can't get into or I don't want to, you know, type of thing. And so the lawmakers then reacted and said, uh-oh, you know, let's slow this thing down. So that's when the lawmaker withdrew. And I think my guess is he was advised to by his colleagues to pull it back for a while. But he stated publicly, I reserve the right to bring this back. So to answer your question before, I don't think we've seen the end of it yet. I think there's still that struggle. You know, how does a small sector of our culture, which according to the United States Census Bureau represents about 2% of our culture that identifies themselves as LGBTQ, have the right to influence all the other minorities in our culture and majority type of thing. So and you and I were talking about this earlier too. It's interesting is that, you know, for years they felt like they were in the closet. And, you know, and as a culture, we definitely put them in the closet. Now they've come out of the closet. They're trying to push the evangelicals back in the closet. And you would think there would be a sensitivity there on their part as well as our part to say, okay, let's agree to disagree. We're going to move forward. We don't agree with each other, but we're going to live in this wonderful country where pluralism and diversity is respected and honored and move forward to what we believe is best and how we can live together.
Dr. Kirtan, it does seem like the strategy perhaps has been pressure, intrusion, coercion, some of those things is – you know, it's not necessarily overt, but it's you know, we'll take away your funding or we won't hire your students, you know, if they have a degree from your institution. Is that kind of the wave of the future, do you think, in some of these hot-button issues?
I think that's one way that certain sectors of our legislative bodies are looking at it. You and I talk about heart issues, touching the heart, and that's how people change lives. And coming from our worldview, we believe the Holy Spirit changes lives and by touching the heart. A certain sector of our society believes it's you change people through regulations. You change people through laws. You change people through ordinances. And that's what they're trying to do. You and I, it's like, let's change your heart. Let's talk about this idea. Let's discuss and let's debate this and let's, you know, respect each other. Even though I disagree with the lifestyle you've chosen with, yeah, I'm still going to love you and engage with you and communicate and talk and develop that relationship, even though, you know, I disagree.
Dr. Alan Kirtan is president of the University of Northwestern and Northwestern Media, of which the Faith Radio Network is a part. And I thank him for his insights today on Connecting Faith. We'll hear some more from Dr. Kirtan coming up later this week. A quick reminder, we're just a week away from our fall fundraiser. Join us for that here on Faith Radio. Find out more at myfaithradio.com.